I'd like now to welcome Igor Volsky. He is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. And he's been on the show a number of times to talk about healthcare reform. And we are talking today. He's in Washington, D.C., having an update. Welcome to the Radio Cafe, Igor.
Thanks for having me back on. Happy to be here.
So where are we with healthcare reform now? We started out a couple of months ago talking about the possibilities for a public option. These seem to now officially be dead, killed by a combination of the Senate and the insurance industry itself. Is that right?
I think that's right. We knew from the very beginning that the public option was going to be an uphill climb, especially in the Senate, where you need 60 votes to break a filibuster. And as it turned out, several senators, Ben Nelson from Nebraska, Joe Lieberman from Connecticut, played kingmaker and decided that they wouldn't vote for a bill that includes a public option. And so they took it out single-handedly. Joe Lieberman, of course, Connecticut has a lot of insurers in that state. And so it's certainly not surprising that a senator from Connecticut, a senator who's taken a lot of insurance money throughout his career, would try to strike the public option from the bill. And if you look at his reasons for opposing a public option, they don't really make sense either. So you're only driven to believe that there's some influence here. But you're right to say that it looks like we won't have a public option in the final bill. We'll have just an exchange of private insurers, which, you know, if designed correctly, could still work. But I think I, along with many progressives, as we saw this past week, are very disappointed.
There's a couple of things about it that are disturbing, I think, from the point of view of people who have been either bankrupted by healthcare costs or have not been able to afford insurance at all. And one of them is that these people like Joe Lieberman don't seem to be representing their districts. They seem to be representing the corporations in their districts, which is not the same thing. Do you have a sense of what the public outcry and the public participation has been on this issue?
Well, it's pretty phenomenal. The public option, which is so unpopular in the Senate, is actually the most popular aspect of healthcare reform among the public. In fact, as this process has been moving forward, American people have been losing faith in healthcare reform, but their support for the public plan has actually remained steady. So I like to say that as the bill became more and more conservative, Americans supported it less and less. That's very important to point out, especially in the media climate that covers the story as a he said, she said, as what will Joe Lieberman do, what won't he do. I think to highlight the public's position, which has always been for giving Americans a choice between public and private coverage, is very significant, and it's not a choice they're going to have in this reform.
It's also disturbing, I think, to many people in the public because the majority seems not to rule. It's a little confusing. During Republican administrations, it never seems that you need 60 votes in the Senate to do anything, but during Democratic administrations, you can't do anything without 60 votes.
Well, you're right to say that a lot of the signature bills under Bush, primarily the tax cuts, were shepherded through using reconciliation. When the Democrats took over, they made the decision, and the president made the decision, that they're going to go through regular order. Now, part of this, of course, they're hoping that some Republicans would join. When you're doing very large reform, it always kind of makes sense and makes better policy, I think, to try to do it in a bipartisan way. But as it turned out, Republicans weren't interested in jumping on board. But also, of course, there was the concern that if you do health care through reconciliation, you really have to do two separate bills. One bill that is able to withstand the very tough reconciliation process, because only provisions that directly affect the budget can go through reconciliation according to the Senate rules. So things like insurance regulations wouldn't be able to be in the bill. And so it kind of created this other layer of complication that if you do it through reconciliation, you'll have what Max Baucus liked to say, Swiss cheese reform. So they tried to avoid that. Should they have gone through reconciliation, pushed the public option through? I think that's a debate for another day, but certainly they tried to go a different route, a more conciliatory route, and unfortunately they were really not even met halfway by Republicans.
Obama, when he was a candidate, expressed support for a single-payer option, and I found it odd that he himself took that option off the table, even as a potential bargaining chip, before the process even started, very much supported the public option, but really treated that as a bargaining chip very early on. And now we have a bill which, although, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that it is health care reform, is basically a gigantic giveaway to insurance companies.
Well, there is an argument to be made that if he had kept the public option on the table, we would see a more progressive reform. You know, it's that old Malcolm X, Martin Luther King dynamic, that Malcolm X was the foiled Martin Luther King, which is why we have civil rights reform in this country, because people thought, my goodness, if I don't deal with Martin Luther King, I'll have to deal with Malcolm X and black nationalism, and they certainly didn't want to do that. So there is that dynamic and that school of thought that if only he would have kept single payer on the table, we would have something with a public option. But as far as his own views during the campaign, my understanding has always been that he has said that if he was to start the system from scratch, unwind everything, go back to day one, he would have preferred a single-payer system. But given the fact that we have the majority of Americans in private coverage and employer-sponsored plans, that starting from scratch was just simply impractical. And I think many progressives agreed with that, not just from a political point of view, but also from a care continuity policy perspective as well. It's difficult, I think, in general to make the conclusion and the leap that this health care reform or this Senate bill is a giveaway to insurers. It's true that insurers will have some 20 million new customers, and I say 20 because about 10 to 15 million are going to go into Medicaid. So they're going to have some 20 million new customers, but at the same time, they're going to have to clean up their act. They're not going to be able to deny coverage because of pre-existing conditions. They're not going to be able to rescind coverage. So they're really going to be operating in this new environment of managed competition. They've never done that before. And I think that's very, very significant. So if you look at some of the analysis that's been conducted about how the various healthcare proposals would affect the health insurance industry, it's not that they lose money, because they certainly don't, but it's that they stay about the same, but more importantly, that you really do have a situation where millions and millions of Americans benefit from reform. So I don't think it's either one or the other, that it's either the insurance industry that benefits or the American people. I think you can strike a balance where you extend coverage to 20, 30 million people, where you regulate insurer behavior, and at the same time, you don't you don't bankrupt the insurer industry.
We're talking to Igor Volsky, healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress and co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Now, Howard Dean himself has, at least the last I read, not been very happy about this Senate bill.
Well, Governor Dean and I have argued on this point. This past Sunday, he walked back a bit from earlier comments he made that the Democrats should kill the bill in the Senate and start over either in 2 years after the midterms or just take the process back to reconciliation. I disagree with that. I think that this provides a foundation for reform that we can build upon. It again extends coverage to 30 million Americans. It does all these new insurance reforms, and I think that's significant. You know, while I share, obviously, his loss, his grief over the loss of a public plan, we wrote a whole book saying how important it was. I think it is possible to get at some of the goals of a public plan through regulatory means, and I hope that Congress does this. But to throw this away and to say, let's start over, I think is fairly impractical.
What kind of regulations, besides taking away their ability to not give you coverage because of pre-existing conditions and not rescind coverage and so on, what kind of regulation is the healthcare industry looking at? Are they still going to make us pay all sorts of co-pays and out-of-pocket expenses, or is that going to be better for the customer as well?
Well, there are some out-of-pocket protections in the Senate bill. They're not as good as they should be, but they're there, particularly for the lower-income Americans. But what you're also doing, you know, the pre-existing conditions, the rescissions, no annual or lifetime limits, all very significant reforms. But I can't overstress this point enough that just the very act of putting insurers into a new marketplace called the exchanges in every state, where they have to follow these new rules and literally compete against each other directly, head to head, not on the healthiest applicants, cherry picking the healthiest applicants, but on the quality of care, because now they'll be offering, they'll all be selling a standard benefits package that will be defined. And that's what they'll be competing on delivering care efficiently, not on picking the most healthiest beneficiaries. So I think that's significant, and it's very important that these exchanges are well regulated, that the insurance commissioner in each state keeps his or her eye on the ball to make sure that they're not finding new ways to game the system. That's going to be critical, and I'm not happy that the people who are in charge of overseeing this entire new apparatus are the state commission, the state insurance commissioners, because historically they've not done a very good job, and I would like to see some new kind of oversight mechanism to make sure that everything that they're supposed to be doing, that they're actually doing. That's going to be key. That's going to be a very big battle, and I hope they improve that, if not in conference, because that seems unlikely, then down the road. But, you know, the public option was significant, but the public option was only a small part of achieving competition, lower costs, and better quality care. And if we can now play with the cards that were dealt and get at some of those goals, I think we can, and I think we have to, really.
One of the terrible problems with the system as it exists now is that there are hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people staying in jobs that they do not want to be in, purely for the health insurance coverage. Will healthcare reform affect people's ability to move in and out of jobs and still keep health insurance?
Yeah, job lock, as you point out, is a problem. It costs this country a lot of money in terms of lost productivity. What will now happen is if you choose to leave your job or if you lose your job, you'll be able to enter your state-based exchange, this new marketplace for insurance, kind of like an Orbit for insurance, and you'll be able to choose among a menu of plans. So no longer will you be in a situation where you're 54 years old, you lose your job, you lose your health insurance coverage, and you have nothing, because nobody will cover your diabetes in the individual market. Now, when you enter in an exchange, they won't be able to deny you coverage for that condition. They'll have to take in, they'll have to charge you a community rate, an affordable rate. And of course, you may also, depending on your income, qualify for affordability credits. So that's what I'm saying, is that this bill isn't perfect, but for a lot of people, it's going to make a big difference.
When do its provisions actually kick in?
Some of the provisions, things like you can't deny coverage to children based on pre-existing conditions, no rescissions, no annual limits, high-risk pools, catastrophic coverage, as it's called, for Americans who can't find coverage in the individual market, that kicks in about 60 or 90 days after reform is signed. The exchanges, however, start in 2014.
And you just said no denying coverage to children based on pre-existing conditions. What about adults?
That kicks in 2014 once the exchanges are operational.
So for the next 4 years, the insurance companies can still deny you, me, or anybody else coverage based on the fact that we had gallstones 10 years ago.
They could, but if they do during that interim period, it's possible that they won't be able to participate in the exchanges, because one of the changes that they made in what Saturday was revealed, the manager's amendment to the Senate bill, was they allowed the Secretary of Health and Human Services and the exchange commissioner to look and evaluate their record of denying coverage, of spiking rates, for instance, in the past. And if they are, you know, above a certain threshold or are egregious, then they won't be able to offer what's called a quality benefit healthcare plan within the exchanges. And that's a market that they want, you know, a piece of. And I think that would be a serious problem for companies that go overboard in denying coverage. I mean, it's not a perfect kind of consumer protection, but I think it's an important interim stopgap.
There certainly have been issues in this whole healthcare debate about controlling healthcare costs. Part of it has to do with drug companies and pharmaceuticals, and there were questions of reimportation of drugs from other countries to get them at a lower price. Where does all that stand in the Senate bill as it exists now?
Well, there's no reimportation. Those two amendments were defeated. The administration promises to fight for importation another day, not as part of this reform. I think the administration made a decision, something they learned from President Clinton's failed effort. And that is, if you can get some of the stakeholders, like pharmaceutical industries, insurance companies, if you can bring them to the table, and if you can negotiate with them and compromise with them, then you'll, in the long run, go a lot further in reforming the healthcare system than if you cast them aside and don't work with them. And I think in some respects, they're right. I mean, this administration, in its first year, has gone further than anyone else in history in this country in reforming the healthcare system. And the decision to forgo importation, which is something that the president supported when he was in the Senate, his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, supported when he was in Congress, was a strategic decision, which said, we're going to make an agreement with the pharmaceutical industry. They're not going to attack reform. We're going to pass it. And, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, or whenever, we'll try to do something about drug prices. Was that a fair bargain to make, a fair deal? I think people have to judge that for themselves, but it's clear that they made a decision that it's better to have a better shot at passing reform, at least with these interests at the table, than to get everything you want in one bill and alienate them and possibly risk the possibility of achieving healthcare reform.
Well, that brings up another question, which is, I mean, I think a lot of people, and not just liberals and progressives, but a lot of people, just average Americans, see this as a kind of, we've been held ransom by the pharmaceutical companies, the insurance companies, and Joe Lieberman, and a bill gets passed, and the bill is incredibly imperfect from a lot of people's point of view, and has sold out, and has compromised its essence away in certain respects. How likely is it that there will be further health care reform 2 years from now, 20 years from now, ever?
Well, you know, people raise very similar concerns about Medicare, that it didn't have enough services, it didn't provide very comprehensive benefits. And we saw over the years, legislatures, lawmakers address that. And now, of course, you have hospice care in Medicare. You have drug coverage in Medicare, things you didn't have when the law was first passed in 1965. And so I think a lot of reforms in this country, because of the way our politics is and the way our government is structured, you have a foundation, and then you build on that foundation over the years. And I think the same will happen with healthcare reform.
Igor Volsky is a healthcare researcher for the Center for American Progress. He's co-author of the book Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. What happens now? The bill, if it passes the Senate, and that does look like the likelihood, right?
I think so. I think they will pass it on December 24th, Christmas Eve, at around 7 p.m., I think, is when they have it scheduled.
So if and when that passes, it has to then be reconciled with a House bill that is very different. What happens then?
Yes, the House bill is quite different. It has better affordability credits, better protections for out-of-pocket caps for lower-income Americans. It has a real employer mandate that requires large employers to offer coverage. It's a better bill. I think many progressives would want to see the House bill become law. But again, given the 60-vote rule in the Senate, that just won't be the case. And so what they'll have to do is go into conference. And I think, unfortunately, the House, which has worked very, very hard on reform, is going to have to adopt most, if not all, of the provisions in the Senate bill and pass reform. Because, again, anything that screams of a public option or Medicare buy-in or something that removes the excise tax on high-cost plans, that's in the Senate bill but not in the House bill, will simply be rejected in the Senate, and then we're back to square one. So I think there's going to be a lot of things the House is going to have to swallow. But again, I think if the choice is you either accept a lot of the provisions in the Senate bill or you have no reform at all, I think lawmakers will choose the former.
The 60-vote rule, so if there is a reconciliation committee and they come up with something that is more like the House bill, why do you need, I thought you just needed a majority to pass, I mean, if a bill goes back to the Senate floor, why can't they pass it with 51 votes?
You need 60 votes to cut off debate on the conference report and move it to a final vote. For the final vote, you only need a majority.
Right, right. So that's where it would be held up. Are there, I was reading somewhere that there are movements to amend some of those rules so that so the Senate can't really be held hostage by a couple of spoilers anymore. Do you know the status of all that?
Well, there's some talk about it. Senators Harkin and Lieberman had proposed back in the 90s amending the 60 rule. You know, it's important to point out that the 60 rule isn't some kind of constitutional requirement. It's self-imposed by the Senate, and so they can change it whenever they like. And in the 90s, there was this push to change the way cloture is reached, how many votes you need. It was kind of an incremental scale that first, if you can't get 60, you can get 57, 56, and down from there. I haven't seen any serious discussions about bringing that kind of legislation, that kind of rule change up to a vote. We'll see what happens. I fear, though, it's kind of a passing fad. But you know, when you're in the minority, I think you covet that 60-vote rule, that you can try to stop the opposition. And Democrats have certainly made use of it in the past. But it's, I think, important to point out that nobody, no party, has obstructed progress, not just on health care reform, but on every single piece of legislation that the Senate has seen, like the Republicans in the minority now. It has just been extraordinary. You know, a couple of decades ago, the minority party would filibuster only about 8% of the legislation that came through the Senate. Now, with the Republicans, it's in an all-time high of 70% of all legislation they filibustered. And it not only does it slow down kind of our lawmaking process, but it's the reason why they're there, voting at 1 a.m., voting on Christmas Eve, because Republicans have really slowed everything down.
Igor Volsky, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org. I am reachable at Radio Cafe. I am reachable at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. The podcast site is santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience.